Hello, everybody. This is Schmitty with another episode of Talkin' Schmidt. This is Joe Raposo, childhood friend of mine. I think I met him in 1989, maybe 86, actually, like in the 80s we met, put it that way. Most of you were still 30, you know, like that's how far back it goes. Joe Raposo, you might have heard of him. He's bass guitarist for the punk band Rich Kids on LSD, RKL, and now he plays in Lagwagon. He's done a lot of music, but he grew up a skateboarder, and we're going to talk today and catch up. I haven't talked to him in like 15 years, so you're going to have to excuse me for overdoing it a little bit. We had 3 hours of conversation, which means I broke this one up into two episodes. So today will be episode one, probably have episode two on Friday with the YouTube with both of them together. So you YouTubers that just had to come over and listen to it today, thanks for joining us. I like you guys over here. I like you guys at the YouTube platform too, though. Don't get me wrong. Anyhow, Blood Wizard's been backing us since day one, and I back the shit out of them. My homie Toad is a, you know, partner over there, and he came over and did up our electrical for me this week. And he also mentioned that the future is going to be me and him interviewing Hansi Driscoll. So that just is in just now. And I want to also, I got a lot of news, but I'm going to try to keep it brief. But the other thing I want to tell y'all is Friday, I'm going to have a raffle, and it's 10 people entry. Once the 10th person enters, it's closed. So you're going to want to be on your computer, hit and refresh on talkinschmidt.com. And once that thing goes up, you got 10 items to buy. They're all going to be $20 each. And that enters you into a raffle. All 10 people will win something besides what they purchase. The first prize, top prize, the winner, I don't know. You kind of win no matter what, but the number one thing we're giving away is a skateboard deck. Black Label, Elijah Ackerley. I appreciate all that you guys have done all year supporting me, and this is my way of giving back. And I'm also trying to get rid of the last few items of my merchandise so I can have a little extra room in my cupboards. Yeah, so Friday at some point, probably in the morning or afternoon, not at night, but you never know, the raffle will be born, and it's going to be talkinschmidt.com, and it's the first 10 people. There's only room for 10. So look forward to that, and I really feel strongly about you guys coming to support me on Friday. I know you can do it. Let's try to get that thing sold out hella quick, and then put the raffle up real fast and draw names and get you guys your prizes before Christmas. What do you think? It's all up to you. You've been warned. This Friday, talkinschmidt.com, the raffle of all raffles.
Winner.com. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. I don't think so. Winner, winner, Sheen dinner.
This is Little Joe Raposo, and you're listening to Talkin' Schmidt.
Hey,
Talkin' Schmidt.
I'm already not watching.
It's cool, like tonight is the night.
Damn, this is like the coolest thing I'm ever gonna do.
I wouldn't say it was fun.
What do you mean? Well, Christian Fletcher's younger brother.
Fuck the Dodgers.
All big dogs in. What do you think, Colin?
John? Schmitty?
Talkin' Schmidt.
Alpha Macaroni.
Most of these guys, their opinion don't matter.
Talkin' Schmidt, right?
It's skateboarding.
I remember that.
Talkin' Schmidt.
What are Yuns doing?
Holy shit.
Skateboarding homies.
No, Schmitty, you can't jump in.
What is happening?
I'm here for Greg Smith. Yeah!
Gregory!
Yes, we are!
Wi-Fi check one, Wi-Fi check two.
Woo! All right, warning, the following interview may or may not lead to stories better than Wonder Years and Stand By Me. Nick, Chad, Mike Alcantar, Larry, Oscar, Kessler, 650, this one's for you. And it goes like this. I met this dude on a bus ride. I was going to the farm in San Francisco to see a punk show. He's on the bus with skateboard and his friend Mike Alcantar. We're instantly drawn to each other. They tell us about a pool. We tell them about the punk show. Next thing you know, this guy's an RKL. I'm working at Thrasher. So this is going to be the story that goes into all of that. And dude, I don't think I've talked to you for like 15 years. Welcome to the show, Joe Raposo.
Thanks a lot, buddy. It's good to see you. It's good to be here. I love your podcast. You are doing a great service to the skateboarding community. So thank you very much. Sharing all the stories with all these legends throughout the years, and it needs to be done. And thanks for doing it.
Yeah, I feel like the more times that we, you know, you and I have both lost people that were real close to us. And when those things happen, what's the first thing that goes through your mind? Man, I wish I, man, I should have. And so my life turned into, I got to fucking record some of the stuff with these special people that I know, because you never know when someone's going to leave. And I just, my memory's not that great. So I want to have it, you know, documented. And so super Me stoked.
Too. Me too. In fact, it's going to be really hard to like remember this stuff. So I was actually talking to Mike Alcantar this week, and we were just like catching up and then like reminiscing about like the old days, like San Mateo Skates, like the Redwood City crew, how we all met. How we got to like meeting people in the skateboard scene in San Mateo, learning about the Spillway, like probably the first skate spot I ever skated that was like Same. Any kind of transition, right? Like,
yeah,
even though it was like this, it was still pretty fucking burly, you
For
know?
Sure.
And cutting your teeth on that spot like really taught you a thing or two about riding hills, riding transition, and then just meeting a whole bunch of like really cool people. Like, who was it? Joel, who was like pretty much the ambassador of the Spillway because he lived like up the hill,
right up on Alameda or something, right off up there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. He would come rolling down, I think from his backyard down the hill with like a shovel and a broom, and his whole like constitution would be to roll down there and sweep it up and get ready for the day. And if you were on top of it to get there super early, you would see him, you know, like he would be there and he'd be getting everything ready. And it's pretty radical, man. And he taught me a lot about skateboarding because at that point, I never rode any kind of transition or anything else like that. I think I probably did some hill riding and stuff. But once you got like a piece of the Spillway, like it was addictive. Like you had to always go back there. And I would skate from my house in San Mateo, where it was like by the 101. I mean, you've been to my house before, right? Remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and the Sunny Bray. And so it's like right by the 101, and I would almost like what go over Hillsdale, almost go to like the top of the 92 and skateboard there almost every day when I was like 14 years old, just to skate that place.
Yeah, I've told the story before, but when I bought my first board, it was at Go Skate, which was on 41st in San Mateo. And the guy, I don't know if it was Larry or not, I can't remember. I kind of feel like it was Mark Dale's son. And he said, go to this spot. And he gave us directions, and it was the Spillway. And I remember walking in kind of a timid kid, and there's like older dudes, which I don't know what that means at now, because it could have been 3 years, it could have been 10 years, but they were definitely smoking and drinking. This was kind of new to us, like, whoa. And it was just that cool feeling of, this is a world that like mom and dad don't like, you know, like we're doing something right now that's like our shit. And like, once you started rolling on those trannies and stuff, like you said, it was just like, oh my God, you wanted to go faster. You wanted to get up higher. Then they started building those wooden roll-ins so you could get more speed, come in, and then they'd have like a bank on the other side. I don't know if they ever put a tranny, but I know they had like a taller wall and stuff. And then, man, it just went from there. And years went by before you and I and Mike and the San Mateo guys kind of connected with the Redwood City, and I was from San Carlos. But it was just so, like, the story, there's so many fucking connections that like over time you're just like, oh my God, because here we are back again at Ghost Gate, which was our local shop. We're smoking weed. We're fucking drinking. We're checking out the new Gons when it comes in, looking at Mark Gonzalez in the mag saying, hope he's in every issue because he's our favorite. And like doing the run down 41st, hitting the Ollie bump and learning wall rides. And then Oscar, I mean, there's so much that goes into it. Like Oscar Polchowski kind of, I feel like he kind of opened the door of connecting us maybe with Bryce, and that led us to Ray Myers' ramp. And then Tobin starts coming down and Bryce is shooting photos. And the next thing Mike's in Sick Boys. Like it's just insane. There's, yeah. And the crazy part for me is I'm looking at it and I'm like, this is a window that's like this. It was like 85 to 88 or something, like 2 or 3 years, all this stuff happened.
Yeah, it was
when we not obviously when we first started skating. I think when I first got my board, it was like maybe 82 or 83. It was like fifth or sixth grade when I got my first board. So, yeah, but like, were you born and raised? Where were you born? Because I know where you were raised.
I was born and raised in San Mateo. So the house that you know, that you visited when we were skating together way back in the day. My parents still live there. My parents are still alive and they still live in the same house in San Mateo.
Amazing.
And that's where I was born and raised. And I see them about like 2 times a week. I try to go and visit them. I'm now in San Jose.
Okay.
I've been in San Jose for about 12 years. And as you know, like living in the peninsula, like going to San Jose is like going to LA to skate, you know, sometimes it's like so far away. Going to San Francisco, not so much, you know, we used to go all the time, you know, Fort mm-hmm. Miley, the HP ramp, you know what I mean? And the dish up at Hunter's Point too, you know, like those were always the first stops because they were like really close, at Barcadero. But like San Jose, it was like one of those places where it was like, you know, kind of hard to get to. But once I moved up here, I realized that it like, you know, has a big, huge skateboarding community. It always has. And it's sure. pretty rad. And the cops don't fuck with you here at all if you're skateboarding. They actually encourage it. So it's awesome. Yeah, it's cool, dude. You can skate anywhere you want in San Jose and cops will not fuck with you at all. The homeless will, but the cops won't.
Yes.
You know.
Well,
San Mateo, go back to San Mateo. Yeah, that's where I was born and raised, and that's where I started skating. And then I met Mike Alcantar when we were 8 years old. His parents moved in on that same block on Carlisle. Mm. And that's when I met him for the first time, you know. And then Dave Ron, who was in RKL and in Lagwagon, was right around the corner on Guilford. He was the first drummer I ever jammed with ever.
No,
we were like
way.
13 years old and we're still in a band together. Isn't that crazy?
It's so crazy. I knew he was from San Mateo, but I didn't know he was that close to you. Did you and Mike get into skateboarding together then?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. My first introduction to skateboarding was my brother. So my brother always had the cool toys. Like my parents would never buy me shit. In fact, my parents were like pretty, you know, they were middle class, but like they would not, they were old school. They wouldn't spend a lot of money on extracurricular toys or activities and things like that. And my brother had a paper route. So he would buy the skateboard. He would get the BMX bike and he would get all that stuff. And I would get the hand-me-downs. So my first skateboard was just like, a Sims, and it was, I don't know what model it was, but I know it was a Sims, and it was pretty much, you know, like your token 70s banana board type of thing, just really thin, you know, like a 5-incher or something like that. And it had Sims wheels on it. I forget what trucks it had, but dude, it was like, it was pretty hard to ride. It was really hard to ride. I mean, I fell on so many sidewalk cracks on that thing, you know? But after a while, like my brother got into BMX, he just gave me that skateboard. And so I just rode that thing everywhere. And so that was my first board, and that was my introduction to it. I don't think Mike Alcantar was even skating at that point. Yeah. And then it wasn't until middle school that Mike and I started getting into skateboarding, because I believe that my next skateboard after the Sims was an Alva. It was Alva that I scored from someone around the corner that was just selling it. And that was like my real skateboard, you know? And then we went to middle school, and that's when, like, I think the skateboarding surge happened. You know, there was the Caballeros, the Hosoys, you know, like all those like gleaming glossy models that had everything, copers, tail guards, nose guard, you know what I mean? Like everything, like all the accessories, all the peripherals, like everything. And so that was like sixth grade for me. And I remember me and another friend of ours, like, and I know this is like bad skateboard karma, but like everyone would put their skateboards in the office, you know, to like save them so they wouldn't get stolen. And me and my friend ended up stealing a skateboard brand new in the office. We're like, no, this is ours. And then we stole the board, and we start disassembling it in the bushes somewhere. And I guess the kid who had the board, he was like crying. And it was like, well, his special board, dude, it was so sick. It was a brand new Hosoi. We were like, that kid doesn't deserve that. We deserve this board. And so we're partying it out for our skateboards, like the wheels and everything else. And we got busted by the shop teacher. Found us. They were looking for us, man. And we got busted by the shop teacher. And then we went to the police off, you know, the police department. They basically, you know, called our parents. They didn't book us or anything. I mean, we were young. We were probably about like 12, 13 years old or something. And my parents came and picked me up. And my dad was so fucking pissed at me. He took my Alva that I paid my own money with and fucking smashed it with a sledgehammer in the back.
I was there.
Wow, said, don't ever steal again, or this will happen to you. You know, I was just going, oh my God, dude, this sucks. I mean, he fucking obliterated that thing. He, like, the trucks were all fucking bent. There's wheels flying. That thing was in slivers, dude. And it was like Tony Alvin. I was like, oh my God.
That's cool that he took his rage out on your board, not you, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
he made me watch too, which was, you know,
a little pain. Yeah, yeah.
It was a little traumatizing, you know. So like the next board that I got, I really appreciated it. And then for my birthday that year, my dad actually bought me a Veriflex Vectra. That I was like, God, this is a piece of shit. But I didn't want to, you know, like tell him, you know, like, hey, man, it's cool. Just thanks for buying a new skateboard, you know?
So. Yeah. What middle school did you go to?
I went to Burrell.
Oh, you did? And then you went to Aragon or San Mateo? Where'd you?
Aragon High School.
Okay. And was Burrell the one that we skated, like that had the small handrail and the small water faucet, like Oscar did a wall ride over it, or was that Abbott?
That was Abbott.
It was? Okay.
Yeah. Because we'd always have to do that. And then Oscar would do those sick, like, dude, Oscar was so fucking such a sick skater. So innovative, too. Not as innovative as Pete Colpitz, but like, dude, I remember he would do like these crazy wall rides to Grimes, like up like way high, like 5 feet, you know? And I was like, holy shit, how is he even getting up there? But dude, just he would like manhandling, take all his fucking weight.
Oh yeah, he was a big dude, powerhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know what came first, but Oscar had, I think it was a subscribe ad. It was like a full page ad in the mag, and he's doing a wall ride off a loading dock and grabbing, I think, slob, its front side. So it's kind of like high to low. And that was actually in San Carlos, like where I grew up, down in the warehouse district. And then probably right around the same time is Mike getting the couch potato ad for Venture, where he's doing a wall ride. I believe it was over Mickey Reyes, maybe, in that school. And that same day, Julian did the front board out in front. It was like, that was a crazy day. But like, these were huge influences for all of us. And it was also at a time that street skating kind of just started like taking over, and vert skating was dying, and there was this new thing. And you guys seem like, when I met you guys, you were already like jump ramp champions and like starting to do wall rides and stuff. And it was like really early on. And I just remember like a frontside wall ride with no hands was insane at that time. And those were going down in San Mateo and stuff. And then we would find the bank to walls, and like the, I remember Mark Kessler was the first person I saw board slide a bench at the mall, Hillsdale Mall. One of those wooden ones, he would just, and I think he put two benches together and did a double or something. But these are just like things I remember in my mind that are like, man, this is pretty good. Like what's in the mag right now, comparatively, it's better, but not that much better. Like these dudes are really good at skateboarding. And I was like, lucky enough to have like photography as a background, and I wasn't as good as them, but I was trying, you know, and I would be taking photos and stuff, and we just really bonded, and we had Go Skate as kind of our, as our clubhouse, if you want to call it. Like Larry was always working, it was always a good time. We'd meet up there, sometimes we'd meet up there early and go up to Pacifica, Devil's Pit, and Fort Miley, Chad Blakeney would do it, and then we'd come back. But yeah, I mean, too many memories.
Yeah, yeah, so many memories. I mean, shit, like at that point, you know, skateboarding was our lives. I mean, like, you know, we would skate every fucking day. Every day, no matter what, hands down, like we would skate. You know, and having Mike just right down the street from me, it would just be like, we wouldn't even plan it. We would know that we were skateboarding. I would go knock on his door and he'd be like, okay, man, I'm ready. And then we'd skate from San Mateo to Belmont to go skate. I mean, almost Belmont, you know, and we would start our day there. And it was so cool because like, you know, a lot of that stuff, like I said, was not planned. Like you would cruise over there or someone would cruise over there and they'd be like, well, what do you guys want to do today? Where do you want to skate? And then we just like get in a car and go somewhere, you know, It was so rad. And then until that happened, we were, you know, in the front, we were, you know, going down 41st. We were hitting that ollie hip, just like you said. And then later on, we built that little ramp in the back in the parking lot and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there was always something to do, you know, and I loved Go Skate. I mean, if it wasn't for Go Skate, and even though I wasn't officially sponsored, I'd always say that I was sponsored, but like they got a lot of free work out of me because I would just be hanging out, but they trusted me enough to go in the front and help customers and things like that. And I would do sales, but I couldn't, you know, do transactions.
Right.
And so Larry would just be back there and he'd be like, Joe, go help these people, you know? And I'd just be like, okay. And I never got paid officially. I never got a paycheck from him. But every once in a while, Larry would be like, thanks for the help, and just hand me the board that I'd want, you know?
And exactly, I'd be like,
fuck yeah, you know? So Dale, those guys got a lot of free work out of me for hardly no pay.
Well, the thing on top of that I just was reminded is that stickers were not charged. Like, we would charge the customer, but we wouldn't ring them up. So sticker money went into this separate pile that was our beer fund for the day. So at the end of the day, we had a pile of sticker money that never got rang up, and we would go get a 12 or however much we had for it. And that was our free beer money. So that was, I mean, we were swindling our whole life. Like, you know, we weren't really rich or anything. So it was like the boards are still the same price, which is so crazy. But like, you know, they were probably 100 for a complete 120 or something like that. But yeah, it was just like super cool. And the influences that were being brought together were kind of like all, they were just like adding. It was like, we're all into this, but then somebody would bring something new, and then someone would bring something new. And it was just like, it was this big thing we were building together, kind of, you know. And then the thing I was tripping on was like Nick Bancroft, Chad Blakeney, Mark Kessler. Like, what's the order that you start meeting people besides you and Alcantar that lived on the same street? Like, how did, because you guys already had that crew when I met you.
Yeah. So it all happened in middle school, right? Oh. So like I was basically like a rocker Hesher, you know, AC/DC shirts and shit like that. Quiet Riot, you know, this is like the early 80s. And then Mike Magana and Mike. Oh, yeah. You remember those guys?
Yeah, Magana for sure. And then what's that other guy's name? I think he went to Sarah, right? Brad Ridgway. No.
Oh, Brad Ridgway, yeah, and Brad too, yeah, totally. So those guys didn't come in high school, but like Mike Magana and Mike Sebag, like when I was in the eighth grade, those dudes started getting into punk. So they were coming to school in like army jackets, and I remember like Mike Magana had a mohawk, and even though I was like still a Hesher, I had my skateboard, you know, I had my Veriflex, and I would take it to school every day. That's how I got to school and back every day. But those guys were skate punks. And I was like, holy fuck, like what is all this shit about, you know? And since they had skateboards, I was like trying to like be friends with them, but they were like, who the fuck are you? You know, like you listen to lame music, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like wanting to, you know, like meet them and see what this whole shit was about. And finally we just became friends. And that was my first introduction into like real skateboarding and real punk rock. Cause I would hang out with those guys afterwards and we'd go to Mike's house and play punk records and then, and look at Thrasher magazines and get high and shit.
Yeah.
And Mike Magana's house, he had the stack of Thrashers and he had the weed, you know, and then Mike Sebag had like all the punk records. So we just go smoke weed, look at Thrasher magazines and listen to punk. And that was like my first introduction. And then, so after that, I got Mike because Mike was skating then too. We started meeting those guys up. And then it was three Mikes and a Joe, I guess. Right. So that was like the first little skate crew that we had. And then we started going to Go Skate. And that's when we found the Spillway and everything else like that. So that was the first crew. And it wasn't until I think we went to the Spillway that we like met like Alan Biscard.
Oh yeah.
And Pete Colpitz, because uh-huh. Alan and Pete were like really, really good friends back in the day.
Yeah.
And then after that, it was like Alan Biscard, Pete Colpitz. And then we became like a little crew, you know, like that would be like the San Mateo crew. And then we started finding all those like little weird ditches along the 92.
CSM.
Yeah. The Salamander ditch and the CMN ditch.
And Sammy's, right? Was that one?
Yeah. Sammy the Salamander. That was Sammy's. but I think that came a little bit later, but like, this is like the infancy, like the real beginning. And then when we started, going to high school, that actually grew into a bigger crew because we started meeting more people in high school.
Exactly. Same.
And then, I think right around high school, or maybe it was sophomore year, that's when we started meeting you guys. That's when we were ditching school and taking the buses to farm shows and you know, San Francisco skate spots and things like that. And then Go Skate became like kind of like a regular hangout at that point too. This all happened between freshman year and sophomore year.
Yeah, I remember it vividly that you guys were going to a pool at Cappuccino and you were like, do you know about the pool? And we're like, no, what do you talk about? And you're like, there's a drain pool in this high school. And you guys gave us the info. And I think either one of your numbers or both of your numbers. And then, but we were going to a show at the farm. So then later we reconvene. And now I think I could be wrong because there was also a pool in San Carlos early on, but I think the Cappuccino one was the first one I ever skated. And that was because you guys gave us the in on that. And yeah, I was going to ask you though, when Begonia and you guys met up, do you remember at all what some of those records were? Like, what are your earliest influences? Like the punk records that you're listening to that really maybe you still in your mind remember because it was so like, whoa.
You know, the funny and ironic thing is that there were those Mystic compilations, you know, in that mix. And there was also RKL on that too, you know what I mean? But it was like the Mystic stuff. It was rap music for rap people. You know, remember that record?
Yeah, for sure.
That was like my introduction into, I guess, skate rock too, because Tales of Terror was on there. Yep. There was Flipper. What else? I mean, there it was obviously your Charge GBH, your Exploited, Bad Brains was in the mix, and Bad Religion too.
So these guys were on top of it somehow. They were already in, like, we got this shit. Because those are influential bands to this day, right? Like Bad Brains Forever, like RKL. I always say this story is like in Redwood City, RKL was one of, if not our favorite punk band. And the guys in Redwood City that were playing in their own band, Discontent, if you listen to them, you're listening to somebody that's totally playing RKL songs, but just new songs. They're trying to, at least. I mean, you know, it's really very similar. And it was all just homage because that was the band we loved. They were so unique, you know, like with Jason's vocals and Bomber's drumming, it was just like, what the fuck is this? This is like an explosion of radness. Like, whoa, you know, you're in. And so, yeah, it's interesting that, I don't know, was it 87 that like you actually go to try out?
It was 87. I forget what month it was, but yeah, it was definitely in 87. And Dave Cotter. So to elaborate on your point, right? Like, I was actually jamming in a band at that time that sounded like RKL too.
Was that Morning Boners?
Morning Boners was before that time. That was So I think first it was like Morning Boners, then it was like Terminal Oppression, right? With Joe Markey and Dave Cotter was like part of all these bands. And then I think Morning Boner was a conglomeration of Redwood City punk rockers and San Mateo punk rockers, right? Because wasn't it Scott who was in that band?
Yeah, I think so. Right?
Yeah. And then we formed Terminal Rage with Joe Markey and Sean Yearsey. And then that turned into Terminal Oppression. And then that turned into Wild Style. That's when most of us at Aragon, because we skipped so much school and we were skating all the time and shit like that, we had to go to continuation school. And so we went to Peninsula.
Or Penn, yeah.
Yeah, Penn State, we'd call it. and Penn State had a fucking
the pool
there too.
Yeah. Where the deep end's in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. So we would skate like the corners. So we would drop in on one side, right, and go all the way down, come up the other, and then hit the corners, like the little corners on the side.
I remember that, but it was gnarly. Like, I think it was fiberglass or something. Like, you would inhale all this gnarliness.
Cappuccino was also fiberglass too.
If you remember.
And then you would inhale all these fiberglass fibers and stuff like that. We didn't give a shit.
Was Wild Style the band that kind of was similar to Arkale?
Yes. Yeah. So it was Wild Style at that point. And basically we were like an Arkale cover band, but playing originals, you know, but it sounded like Arkale songs too. So at that point, Dave Cotter had seen flyers for Arkale looking for a bass player on Hate Street. And he was trying to convince me to try out for the band. But at that point, like, I was more into skateboarding instead of music. And music, you know, even though I was like totally into it, it wasn't as important to me as skateboarding was. Like, I wanted to see if something could happen. Like, you know, right. Because, I mean, we were devoting our whole time into it. I wanted to see, you know, Mike at that point, I believe, was already sponsored by Venture, you know? Yeah. And I felt like, you know, if I just just practice even more, maybe I'm not too far behind, you know?
Kessler was sponsored by Vision, I think. Like, they would send him stuff anyway. Like, some of our dudes. And then we met Oscar, and he was on SMA. And then we're, like, skating with the city guys. And, like, it's just like, this could happen. And yeah, I think like if you stayed 100%, but that's kind of one of the things I always wondered about you is you were probably as good of a skater at that time as you were a bassist. You know, you were very talented in both areas, and it must have been like, at some point you got to pick a road. You got to just devote everything to one, because you can't just be the jack of all trades. You got to be the go this way and just fine tune this craft. And RKL is like probably a childhood dream. So getting that opportunity is like, well, let me see what this is about.
Yeah. And I think the thing that made the choice for me is that, when I joined the band and we did our first European tour, we got like fucking huge in Europe. Like, we ate shit for 3 months or 2 months in Europe, but we gained like this huge following. So when we came back the next year in like 88, it was 88 that we toured at 89. Dude, our shows, like, we were playing squats in front of like 150 people at first, you know? And then when we came back, we were selling out places that were like 800 to 1,000 people. And this is like fucking like 89, you know? Mm. And I remember before the 89 tour, I had been skating back behind Ghost Skate, and I had fractured one of my fingers on my left hand.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, and this was right before the tour. And I'm like, fuck, what the fuck am I going to do? You know? So I went to the doctor, and the doctor's like, well, it's a hairline fracture, you know, but you're going to have to splint it. And so I did that whole tour with like a fractured finger on my left hand. And I would ice it every night and then heat it up, like put it in really hot water before every show to play. And then I would splint it when I wasn't playing. So at that point I was like, if this is getting dangerous for my music career, I need to, you know, like kind of find a happy medium. Okay. So I still skateboarded, but like, I still have this rule where I won't skate like maybe a couple of months before I go out on the road, or when I'm out on the road, I won't skate, just because I mean, there's so much involved. There's like, especially with big tours and Lagwagon, you know, it's like, I don't want those other guys not to make any money because I decided to go out and skateboard and hurt myself and not be able to finish the tour.
Right. That makes sense. Hey guys, I wanted to let you all know about Magic Mind, a once a day shot that can go along with your coffee to increase your focus dramatically, reduce stress, and give you added energy. I just started taking this to see if it'll help me with daily work focus and improve my sleep patterns. Who knows? It might even get me to start yet another podcast. I got myself a case and have started my daily intake. And after a few days, I've noticed that I wake up not needing coffee as much and my energy levels have been less up and down throughout the day. I shared some with my right-hand man at work and I have a couple friends that have started taking it so we can all be on this journey together. Starting in January, you will find it in all Sprouts Farmers Market stores across the country. If you have a Sprouts store nearby, get down there and grab a few bottles to try. After you're hooked, you can get a subscription with up to 50% off with my code SCHMIT20. That's SCHMIT20. You also can go to magicmind.com/Schmidt if you don't have a Sprouts nearby you. And again, use my code SCHMIT20. It's Christmas time and Magic Mind is a great gift idea as well. If nothing else, your purchases will keep these guys supporting our show. So why not try a case with our promo and see for yourself if it works? That's magicmind.com/Schmidt and the code is SCHMIT20. Start your journey today. We got to talk about this tryout. Like we go to the city. I drove you up. I don't know if it was the first one or the second one. I think you had two, right?
Well, I had multiple like auditions per se. And Dave kind of like to continue my story from earlier on. Like, so Dave's like, you need to try out for this band. I was like, no, I just want a skateboard. That's what I want to do with my life. And then he goes and sets up an audition without telling me. And picked me up one day and says, we're going to the city.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he's like, bring your bass. So he, on our way there, I'm like, what are we going to do? Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, dude, I got to tell you this. I set up an audition for you and we're going to Marin. And it was, that's where Balmer's mom lived at that time. And that's where the audition was. And so he's like, you're auditioning for RKL. And I was like, what the fuck? I'm like, you dick, like this sucks. I'm not even ready, you know? And then by the time we drove from San Mateo to Marin, I kind of accepted it. I'm like, well, fuck, at least like we'll get to meet some of our heroes, you know? And like, you know, meet these guys and see, you know, like what the fuck's up and get to ask them like a whole bunch of questions and things like that. It was like, you know, meeting some like legends or your heroes or something like that.
Yeah.
And so we were like, this is cool. So we went up there and we just sit at Bomber's mom's house. No one was even there. It was so weird. It's like Bomber's mom is like some hippie and she's like smoking weed and she's just all like, oh, hi guys. Who are you? You know, like, we're like, we're supposed to be here for an audition. We're supposed to meet Bomber here. She's like, oh, okay. All right. It's that's totally cool. Do you guys want some weed? Do you guys, you know, want something to eat? And we're like, you know, we don't know what the fuck to think. You know, we're like fucking like 16, 17 years old or something. And we're okay. And then she's like, go into the room and just wait for him. So we're sitting in fucking Bomber's room. No one's there. We're just like looking around at flyers. And we don't know what to do with ourselves, right? We're just kind of like, what the fuck is going on right now? It was amazing. And then Bomber and Barry come rolling in and they're like, hey, what's up guys? You know, like, how's it going? Like, sorry to make you wait. And for, you know, like two kids from the suburbs, you know, nice, squeaky, clean kids. Well, we were totally squeaky clean. I mean, we partied and stuff. But like, yeah. Here come two like pretty fucking burly, crusty fucking burly guys like, from the city. And they stink. And they're like, you know, but they're cool as fuck. Like, we're like, whoa, these are like two of the coolest people we've ever seen in our lives, you know, yeah, uh-huh. And heroes. Stuff like that too. And then Bomber comes in and Bomber's like the regular Bomber. He's just like, you know, off the rails and like all this wild energy and shit. And he's just talking and he's telling stories how he just got over Hep C and stuff like that. And like, oh, geez.
First and we're impression. Kids,
we're like, dude, can we catch this? Like, what's Hep C? Dude, you know what Hep C is? Dude, is that contagious?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, fuck. Yeah.
It was gnarly. And what's crazy about it is that they didn't have any amps or anything like that. Like they didn't even like really they weren't prepared for this audition, put it that way. It was like they just kind of wanted to meet who it was and just rap about, like, you know, what are your influences, like, you know, like, what do you like to play, blah blah blah. And at that Dave and I had like a rehearsal recording of Wild Style. So we put it in the tape player. We kind of show them, and it's like, you know, kind of like RKL Keep Laughing and, you know, It's a Beautiful Feeling type of stuff off the EPs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, this is pretty cool stuff, you know? And then they're like, here, I want you to listen to this. And they had a fucking tape of the rough mixes of Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Which was just mind fucking melting when people first heard it.
Dude, I mean, like that whole sound, I mean, you know, because you know music, and then the listeners who know that album too, it's like, that was like leaps and bounds from what was happening in Southern California punk rock, California punk rock, it's just anything, to what can happen, you know, it's just like progressive punk now, you know? And Dave and I listened to it, and being music geeks, you know, we were just like, holy fuck, what the fuck is this, right? And they're like, yeah, you seem to be pretty cool. Here, take the tape and see if you can learn any of this stuff. And then I'll give you a call. And then we'll set up an audition in the city. And that's when you came in for the second audition, and you drove me up in the orange van,
the VW bus.
Yeah. It was a Westphalia, right? Wasn't it?
Yeah. Pop top. Yeah.
Pop top. That was a sweet ride. So yeah, you drove me up to the city for that practice or audition or whatever.
And it was Barry and Bomber again. Chris wasn't around, I don't think.
Chris was around, but Chris wasn't a part of that whole, like, audition thing.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, so I think that Bomber and Barry were living together at that time, and Dan Seitz. So Dan Seitz was living with Bomber and Barry at that flat. What was it?
It was by the Panhandle, right? Like on Fell or Oak.
It was on Fell. Yeah. Yep. It was right across the street from the Panhandle on Fell. Yeah. Mm. And so that was my second audition, which was basically kind of my first audition. And Bomber started teaching me the songs at that point.
So what was the song that you went in there later to be that was recognized as the first one that you kind of tried to like emulate? Like you just went home and listened to the tape and tried to learn it by listening, right? Like there was no instruction. It was just like, listen to this and try to play along.
Yeah. And I couldn't get any, like my bass skills weren't at the point. My ear was there, but not as tuned as it is now. Now I can listen to stuff and figure it out pretty easily. Like I could jam along with whatever's on the radio or whatever. But back then, and it was like progressive, like my skill level wasn't there. It was like, I was pretty good, but I wasn't good enough at that point to learn those riffs and everything. I listened to it, but I was like, I couldn't learn anything. I tried to, but I couldn't pick it apart. I couldn't learn anything. So when I went to the second audition, I was a little nervous. I was like, hey, I listened to it, but I couldn't figure it out, you know? And Barbara was like, that's okay. You know, I'll teach you. And if you can get this stuff, he's like, then you got a good shot, you know, of being in the band. And I'm like, okay, well, fuck it. Let's just try to learn it, you know? And the first song that he taught me was Hangover.
Okay.
So that bass, and I think we worked on that riff for like maybe 20 to 30 minutes. And then after I got it, he taught me the arrangement. And by the end of the day, I think it was like about 2 hours, I had learned that song. And he was like, dude, you did a good job. You know, like a lot of people can't get this stuff. They don't understand it or whatever. And he's like, you did pretty good. He's like, when can you get together again and learn some other songs? And, you know, I was like, yeah, I could do it later on this week or next week or whatever. And then the next song was fucking Blocked Out. So he put me to the test. I mean, he was like pushing me. He's like, okay, he got hangover. Now let's see if he could get blocked out.
Do you think in retrospect he was thinking, because I don't know, I mean, obviously I'm not a bassist, but to me, Blocked Out might be the hardest song on the album to play for bass. It's just the most, like, there's leads and crazy quick shit. Do you think maybe he was like, if he can get the hardest thing, and I don't know if it was the hardest, but to me it seems like it was, maybe the mentality is like, if he can play this, he can play everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what he was doing. He's like, he put me to the test. He's like, if he can, you know, learn these riffs and actually play them pretty decently, you know, let's really put him to the test, have him learn Blocked Out. And then the rest of the fucking songs are cakewalk. And it was true. And it took me a little longer to get Blocked Out. I mean, that song's fucking like 5 minutes long anyways or something, you know, which is unheard of for a punk rock song. It's like a punk rock, like opus, you know.
And it's like on, Queen punk rock.
Right. And later on, which is funny, it's like we started adding parts to it. Like on the live record, we added an intro to an intro to an intro to an intro before the song even fucking starts. It's like we kept on adding on to it, which is unbelievable. But yeah, I got that. And then I think the next one was a Tribute to the Jester. And after that, it was like, yeah, dude, you got these songs and you're in the band if you want to be in the band. And then the next show, or the first show I ever played with them, was like a day at the farm, you know, in front of like 1,000 people. So it was insane.
Yeah.
That all happened within like
short. A month and a half. Yeah. Yeah. Holy shit, dude. That's crazy. And like, so the really cool thing too is that, like you said, that album Rock and Roll Nightmare wasn't even out yet. So no. When it came out, you didn't really write like the songs. Bomber probably wrote most of the stuff, but you were with the band as it's being introduced as, I mean, arguably one of the most influential albums and just like important albums of punk rock history. Like a lot of these, like, you know, more, they blew up bands, like even NoFX, but like a lot of bands use that as like, we wouldn't be the same without that record.
Yeah. And Fat Mike says it all the time, you know, he's like, you know, the two most influential bands to NoFX, I believe he says, well, three, I think it's like Operation Ivy, Bad Religion, and RKL,
you know.
But RKL definitely, because NoFX just wanted to sound like RKL. You know, I think Lagwagon too in the beginning as well, before Joey started writing a lot of the songs. It was like Derek Plord and why am I drawing a blank? Sean Dewey. Writing most of the songs, and those guys were heavily influenced by RKL too. So like the first two Lagwagon records are very riffy and kind of metally and stuff like that too. In fact, Derek Plord had bought Bomber's white, iconic white Ludwig kit. So yeah, man, like it was a trip, you know, being a part of that scene, being a part of that album, and being recognized as like, I mean, I wasn't the first bass player of RKL, but I'm like the most tenured. So it could be like argued that I'm like kind of the original bass player, but not officially the original bass player. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, what was the first show like? Where are you on the stage? Are you like Caballero behind the amp hiding, or like are you in your full jump mode yet? Or are you in between? Like what's your stage performance?
Oh, dude, fully like because of skateboarding, you know what I mean? Like to me, like performing live, because I never really got to perform in front of a crowd. That was like the first real crowd. I mean, I've performed in front of crowds before, but the only show that one of my bands ever played was finals week at Aragon High School with Terminal Rage, you know? And that was in front of, you know, probably about like 100 kids. And then it just got shut down because it turned into a food fight. Someone threw an apple at Joe Markey, and then Joe Markey took a bite of it and threw it back. And at that point, it just like a full food fight just ensued. And they shut it down after three songs. So that was the first show I'd ever played. And then doing a day at the farm in front of like almost like 1,000 people. And because I was skateboarding at the time, I was like in full jump mode already, because the performance to me was like, you know, like run, like a skate run, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So well, it's always the same. You go to see a band that you love and they don't move and you're just kind of like, like they could be the greatest band, but you want to see at least something. They don't have to go full Richter, but you need them to, I mean, otherwise you could just sit at home and listen to the record. Right.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And at that point, I mean, RKL had been touring for a long time. You know, they already had albums and EPs under their belt and they've done tons of shows. So the rest of the band already had like really good stage presence. I mean, you know, Jason Sears is one of the best frontmen in punk rock for sure. And those guys were already jumping around, and Bomber the Fury behind the drums, and Barry, Chris shredding solos. It's like I just naturally fell in with a band that was already just so professional and so good at what they did. And I just like that was so influential to me. I just started fucking rocking out like immediately.
And who was on that bill? Was Bad Brains on that bill? Who else was on Day at the Farm?
No, Bad Brains was not. I believe it was Verbal Abuse. It was DRI. It was MDC. Who else? I know there was probably about three or four other bands, but all the bands, like, I think there's like video of it on YouTube that you can look up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, the farm for us, like we went to On Broadway and the Mabuhay Gardens, and even the Stone had some punk shows, but the farm, I didn't go to anywhere more than the farm. My first punk show was at the Varsity in Palo Alto. And then we started hearing about San Francisco and we started taking the bus up and it would drop you off right at the farm. So it was like, it gets on the freeway and the first exit off the freeway is the farm. So it was pretty safe for young kids at that time. It felt like anyway. But yeah, I just remember, I always say this, I think DRI and Verbal Abuse played every Friday at the farm when they were in town. It was like them and then four other bands or something. It was just like fucking nuts. Did you ever go to the vats where like they kind of lived or practiced for a while, those beer vats where a lot of punk bands were at?
No, I never. That was before my time. And those guys had moved out of the vats and moved into like real flats in the city at that point. But heard stories about it, and it seems
legendary.
It's really legendary. And I heard stories about it, you know, like where people would actually rehearse in there, like bands would rehearse in there, and they would have it like pretty much kind of like a setup, but people were also like living in there too. And I think it was when those guys first moved to San Francisco, they had nowhere else to live. Mm-hmm. So they heard about the vats and they stayed there for, I think a little while, but not too long, for about a week or something like that.
Yeah. When I talked to Chris, we did an interview a while back and it kind of felt like I don't want to speak for him, but I kind of feel like he didn't really like San Francisco that much, as far as like he grew up in Santa Barbara and this place was cold.
Well, I mean, like think about it, like the two different places, it's fucking totally different, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
and then they're living in the vats. I'm like, you didn't get.
you were like surfing every day. Like fucking beautiful weather, you know, where there's beautiful women all around you and rich people and shit like that, you know, and you're just at the beach hanging out, having a beer with your shirt off. And then you move to San Francisco and you're in the vats.
Who is like the guy that you kind of connected with the most in the beginning? Like when you're all together, like who are you kind of buddying up with maybe more so than the rest?
For me, I think it was me and Chris Rest who buddied up more
Away.
More than, when right away, I think we clicked a little bit more. You know, I mean, obviously Bomber and I were really good friends, and Barry too, you know, but Chris, because he's like a little more mellow than those guys at that time. You know, Bomber has a wiry type of energy, and Barry also like had wiry energy, and he was like always up in the San Francisco scene. It was always going to shows and stuff, and you know, so it was like a lot of stuff going on, and I was just like a teenager, so Chris was like kind of more my speed because he was a little more mellow, and you know, he just, yeah, he was more mellow, and we would talk about music and kind of bond more over music and stuff. And it'd be more of like, you know, kind of a cool little trip. So I ended up like going up to the city and staying with him more, than with Bomber and Barry. And I think it was Chris Rest and I who bonded, first really well, even though that, like, I did have a special bond with everybody in the band, you know, but definitely Chris Rest, I think so, a little bit more. But I hung out with him a lot more.
Right. And how soon is possibly, I mean, this is one of my biggest highlights for sure of my life, that we drive down to Santa Barbara, where the band's from, to play with the fucking Ramones. Are you kidding me? Like, we're with Dead Ted. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I'm meeting all these people that they sing about, and we're going to play with the Ramones. Like, you just like pinch me. I'm fucking dreaming. Like, this is crazy. And then like, what is it? Bomber or somebody's, I think Bomber's pedal breaks. So the Ramones didn't let him use it. So they ended up going to some local place to get another pedal, and the Ramones actually played before RKL. Like, RKL ended up headlining that night. I think it was Goleta. I'm not sure where it was exactly, but it was in Santa Barbara somewhere.
Yeah.
How's is like what? That's pretty early. That's before the European trip, right?
Yeah, that's. Well, let me think about that. I think that might have been.
I think 88.
That, yeah, you're right. That was before the European tours. Yep. It was.
so fucking nuts.
I know, right? Remember going to the China Bowl too? That skate spot out there? It's like fucking like, it was like a burly devil's pit.
Yeah. Was that in Montecito? Where was that? I was trying to tell somebody about that.
Yeah, it was, I believe, I think it was still in Santa Barbara, but it was like kind of going up the hills a little bit.
Yeah, but it was real tall walls.
Really tall walls and really like kind of rocky and abrasive too. So if you fell, you would get fucked up. You know, like really, really bad. It was like Devil's Pit in Pacifica, you know?
Yeah.
Like that place fucked you up if you fell. Like, yeah, it was pretty bad, but yeah, the Casa de la Raza was in Santa Barbara. It was before our first year European tour, I believe. And it was a hi-hat clutch actually,
okay,
that Bob couldn't find, didn't have or whatever. And we asked the Ramones if we can borrow one, but they didn't want us to because, you know, like they only had one and they're like, well, if you guys break it, then we can't go on, you know, and this is our show. And so our crew, which basically our crew was just a whole bunch of friends drinking backstage, got into a fight with their crew. So there was a fucking fight going on back there and they were like at blows with one another and the security had to fucking come and break it up. And we almost didn't play. We almost did not play. And then is it a fact that the Ramones went on before us?
I want to say it. My memory, like I said, my memory is not 100% excellent, but I do believe that they did go on before, but I could be wrong. I definitely was there and I felt like that's how it unraveled. But okay. Do you feel it was different?
I might have felt that maybe RKL did, but we started like super late. And okay. We only got to play like a half an hour. But like you, man, my memory is a little bad because, I mean, when the whole thing was going on, I thought we weren't going to play. So I ended up like just going and hanging out with a bunch of friends, you know, and just drinking. And so I wasn't even like really involved until someone came and found me and said, dude, we're going on. And it's like, okay, shit. And then it's like running to the stage to play.
Yeah.
From what I remember that we found it, I think I know what was going on. What was going on was that the Ramones were going to go on and because we couldn't find a hi-hat clutch, they were preparing for the Ramones to go on. And then they had to tell the crowd that RKL wasn't playing. And so the crowd like started booing and getting really restless and almost like kind of incited a fucking riot because RKL didn't play because that was our town.
Yeah.
And then the Ramones were like kind of getting a little worried about it. And they're like, oh shit, like this is kind of crazy. We might have to cancel the show.
Yeah.
And then we found the hi-hat clutch and got on stage and we only played for about a half an hour or so. So we did actually play, and then the Ramones went on afterwards.
Okay.
I remember.
Yeah, that sounds like it could be possible. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a little foggy. That was 35 fucking years ago, so it's kind of, it's like, you know. But I mean, just like literally looking back, I've done a lot of things, and that still ranks up super high with like, man, when I tell people that, they're like, no way. And I'm like, yeah. I was there. I had lost the shirt, but I had the shirt forever. It was too small and almost too faded, but I just kept it forever because it was such a fucking badge, like for me, you know, like that was an amazing moment. Like it was really like fucking, I can't even overemphasize it, but yeah. Let's get into
So me too. And sorry to cut you off, but like, I just want to say that like, playing with the Ramones for me is like, come on, man. That is like such a bucket list type of thing. Right. And that shirt, I still have that shirt, that original shirt.
Yeah.
And after the show, I got it signed by the Ramones. I went upstairs and met the band because, I mean, come on, man. It's the fucking Ramones. We're playing with the Ramones. I have to meet the band. Uh-huh. So I went up there. And they were really cool about what happened. They were just all like, yeah, so, oh, you're from RKL. They were like, nice to meet you. And sorry about what happened. But, you know, like, I hope you understand that we can't be giving out parts for our gear. And I was like, wow, I can't believe that they're apologizing to me about it. They could have been like, hey, fuck you for fucking getting into a fight with our fucking crew and shit like that. But they were super cool. They signed my shirt and gave me a slice of pizza. And I still have that shirt,
dude.
And it still has the signatures on it. But even though, like it was signed, I wore it like a fucking badge of honor.
Yeah.
And all of them are faded, but you could still kind of see it. And it was the original lineup of the band too. I mean, Marky lineup, but dude, like Joey and Johnny and Dee Dee.
Yeah.
I mean, fucking come on. You know? Insane.
Yeah, dude.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Blood Wizard.
Shop.bloodwizard.com.
Tickety tack.
Hey, it's Corey at Blue Plate, 3218 Mission Street. Come see us. Meatloaf, fried chicken, deviled eggs, Dollar Olympia beers. We're here every day of the week. We got a garden and we got smiles on our faces. Come let us make you happy.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talking Schmidt. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Anchor, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. When you subscribe, you'll get notifications every Tuesday of new episodes the minute they become available. Also, please leave reviews and a 5-star rating. It's the best way to help the show grow. All of the episodes will always remain free, but if you would like to help support the show, you can do so at talkingschmidt.com, where you can pick up some merchandise like t-shirts, beanies, hats, and stickers. The website has an entire archive of all of the episodes, with extra photos and videos. Email us with any suggestions, comments, or ways that the show may have improved your life at talkingschmidt@gmail.com. All interviews are conducted, edited, and produced by Schmitty. The intro music is Mary's Cross by the band Nature. A very special shout out goes to the executive director, Cheryl Camisa.
Shout out.
Love it!
This is Talking Schmidt, where the Rolodex is deep, but the conversation is deeper.
Keep the wheels greased.